Welcome everyone to the Words Matter podcast. Words Matter. We are back on the road in Western Massachusetts again. We are here in Springfield, Massachusetts with Savannah M. Taylor to the left of me for everybody who's watching. Savannah is a writer. She is an assistant editor at Ebony Magazine. And tell the people about yourself.
Yeah, first and foremost, thank you so much for having me and inviting me to this opportunity. I'm very excited to just talk about all things words and writing. Savannah M. Taylor, native of Springfield, Massachusetts. I am the assistant editor at Ebony Magazine. I have a lot of varied experience, but writing and words are my passion. They've always been one of my first loves. I've had the privilege of working with Ebony for about 2 years. I've also worked with the Springfield Museums with different digital and social media projects, Afropunks Penned and Stitched, short stint at Cash Money Records, Republic Records, Noir Management, working with different black influencers. I've done a little bit in my time on this earth so far, but like I said, love words, love crafting them, love using them to communicate and tell stories. So. Yeah. Definitely excited to get into that.
Yeah, and just tell us about your background as a writer.
Sure. It's so funny because one of my first memories of writing anything, I won like this short story contest in school. And I was like, okay, well, I could maybe put some words together. I could tell a story, not thinking too much of it. But I used to have like a ton of notebooks. I think that's what most writers say, right? You have like these notebooks and like, wrote down anything and everything, but I was always writing stories, song lyrics, just thoughts, diary entries, all that type of stuff. But I loved how I was able to express myself in ways I maybe couldn't have verbally, which I then learned how to do so later on. But it was always a safe space to be able to write within a notebook for me. So I wrote a little bit by little bit. My first time being published for real came my senior year of high school. I was working with Penned and Stitched, with that, which at that point was semi-connected to Afropunk, if you're familiar with
the, Yeah, of course.
Yeah, Afropunk Festival, I mean, who wasn't? But the Afropunk Festival, and they had this blog going, their social media platform and this blog. And I reached out via social media. I was like, hey, like, I like what you're doing. A woman by the name of Maran Bakel. I was like, you look like me. I love what you're doing. You seem really dope. I'm trying to get like you. And she responded, took a chance on me, and she was like, you know, we're looking for an editor. I was 17. And I was, I don't know nothing about nothing. But she took a chance on me, and she allowed me to edit the writer's stories that we had coming in. I would source them. I would, track them coming in and put them into the CMS on the back end. And I loved it. It was great. I got to go to New York Fashion Week for some smaller shows. And it was, you know, interesting being able just to speak with people. At that point, I was writing about current events, which I loved. I love being black. You'll always hear me say that. So it was great to be able to talk about black issues at such a young age, which then inspired me to get my degree in African American studies at Syracuse University. So that's what I got my degree in. And then I minored in communication rhetorical studies. I was like, why not? But it wasn't just one thing. It was just the power of just words in general as as language and storytelling, documenting history, whatever it was, I loved it. So that brought me there. And I mean, just being able to work in different capacities since then, and then led me to, like I said, Cash Money, Republic Records, Noir Management, and then now with Ebony, I've been really privileged to do work and do some great work there.
It's like you almost answered a lot of questions for me.
Sorry.
That's cool. A lot of the names you brought up and a lot of the, you know, like Afropunk, that's a New York-based festival every year. How do you even learn about these things? How do you know about these things being, I mean, Springfield's not super far from New York. It's only a two-hour drive. But I lived in the area for almost 6 years, and, you know, culturally a lot of things are a world apart.
Yeah.
How do you have that vision to see outside of your bubble of the things that you grew up in what you were exposed to directly?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think for me, that comes with a lot of privilege. I was privileged for my parents to have parents who, since day one, let me know that there was a world outside of the city.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you are welcome to it. You have the ability to go out and seize whatever is out in that world. They took me to Broadway shows as a kid, and, you know, they would take me through Harlem. I remember just getting all, like, dazzled, going through Manhattan, seeing the lights, and taking me on trips, and, like, being able just to imagine more for myself. I think that is a lot of the mentality and the spirit that I've been able to carry with me with whatever endeavor that I've applied myself for, gone after. But specifically with that, I think, honestly, the social media age definitely has played a part.
Yeah.
In that, a lot of the things I can honestly say I've been able to be a part of came out from just me cold DMing people I didn't know, people. And, you know, at that point, I think I didn't really think about it as being that big of a deal. But a lot of things I just reached out to people for. I think also having the spirit of just, like, the worst thing they can say is no, you know, and just going after those types of opportunities. Yeah, I mean, we get told no all the time, especially as marginalized people, black people. Mm-hmm. So that's the worst thing that could happen. And I've been privileged to have, in turn, a lot of yes. Another opportunity I can think of with the Cash Money, that sort of situation.
You're saying you've had a lot of opportunities to be told yes?
A lot of opportunities to be told no, with some opportunities to be told yes, for me taking a chance. And I think it's more about just taking a chance and, like, maybe moving through it just a little bit in a lighthearted fashion. I was, like, 18, 19, 20, and just literally not thinking anything of it. Like, I'm not that far away from that age, but literally just going after whatever and then seeking opportunity. And I think with social media, like I was mentioning, like, you know, my parents had no idea really what social media. They know now. But, you know, coming up, it's like, what is this? It's this open realm. These people are lying. These people are fake. And, like, it was a real thing. But I think my ability to just take a chance and take a risk has served me really well with different opportunities and just reaching out to folks. Like, for Cash Money, I just happened to build a relationship with DMing somebody, which turned out to be a great thing. I know we're probably going to talk about that later, but, like, now that's one of my closest, like, confidants and companions, just reaching out. She ain't know me from nothing, but she did. So I think it's a lot of the fearlessness. And then I think just being from a place where there's either a lot of stereotypes about what you could achieve or what is offered, really just made me want to have more and get more and just create for myself. And that's, again, I think that has to do with a lot of privilege and having people around me who pushed me, believed in me, told me I can go after whatever, but also being around people, young people, who are also, like, of that same spirit.
Yeah. Where are your parents and your grandparents from?
So my parents were born and raised in Springfield.
Okay.
Grandparents from Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee.
Okay.
Down south. My family, primarily is from down south. And my grandparents came up and raised their kids up here. But my parents specifically were born here. So with that, I have a lot of understanding and a lot of reverence for legacy.
Yeah.
And a reverence for understanding the sacrifices that those before me had to make for certain opportunities. And also, I think for me, I take legacy and I take lineage in that sort of sense really seriously. So wanting to make them proud and just doing the most I can for that.
Yeah. But they just, you know, had that. They always had an affinity for, like, arts and culture and stuff. That's why they wanted to expose you.
You know what? I would say my parents did, for sure.
Okay.
My mom, she did, like, she grew up dancing. And, like, I went to the same dance school as she did. I just loved it. My father loves music. I'm not saying he's a singer, but he loves music. And, I mean, I was always grown, like, came up and grew up listening to a lot of just, like, dope artists. And I think there was just an appreciation for the arts, but appreciation just for a whole lot of things. I think just an appreciation for the best in life is what they instilled in me, for sure. Specifically my parents. Yeah, I would definitely say that.
I wanted to ask you, you know, what does home mean to you? You know, because you work at Ebony Magazine and you work for a publication that's based in Los Angeles, right?
So it has roots. So Ebony, prior to maybe like 2020,
yeah,
based in like LA, Chicago, New York. Right now, actually, Ebony has transitioned into a digital first. So I actually work remotely, which has been great because I work from home. Yeah. So, yeah.
But prior to that, like pre-pandemic, and just even with the evolution of journalism and magazines not being in print as much, would you be willing to just up and move anywhere?
You know, prior to the pandemic, that was really all it was. I went to school, Syracuse University. I was like, I'm getting out the city. First chance I get, I'm going, and I'm not sure if I'm coming back. But during the pandemic, having to be home forced me to just sit with a lot, and I've loved being home. I think for me, it's been a reconnection with myself, with my roots, and a way that I didn't set out or have the intention to have. So, but with that, I know that wherever I go, I'm completely open to always traveling and new opportunities. But wherever I go, I know that Springfield is my home. And, like, I'm very proud of it. And literally, the work that I do, whatever I do, I'm always speaking of Springfield in the highest regard. Because if nobody else is going to do it, you know, you have to do it yourself. So I definitely am always open to it, but Springfield will just always be home. There's just a certain spirit and just a certain connection that I feel like will always bring me back.
You grew up around people that exposed you to things outside of your community and let you know that there's more to your direct world.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have a love of community. Where does that love of community come from?
Yeah, I think it goes back to that reverence I was speaking. Like, literally everything about me, like I said, my parents, born and raised, family here, my best friends, born and raised. I went to church here, Martin Luther King Community Presbyterian Church. It just got burnt down a couple of years ago. But community is literally in the name. So, like, and it's in the heart of, the Mason Square community. And I spent good 16, 17 years there. My mother went to the church. My best friend and her family went to the church. Like, it's just generational connection. And I just feel like the way I was raised, it really has to do with just that reverence, that respect, and that understanding of past and history and community. I think that's what fuels my love of community. And also seeing that within the greater Black community and seeing how that sort of emanates and just that general connection. It's just something that I just feel really obligated, but less obligated. I just feel like I'd have no other choice than to build community, than to be immersed in community, than to give back to my community. I think there's no other choice. I think that's I've been blessed with so much. That's the only option I have. But it also isn't really it's not a task.
Yeah.
You know, it's just something that I've always experienced. Both of my families, I always joke my parents, families that kind of grew up in the same neighborhood. They knew each other. Cousins knew cousins on both sides. My mom knew my dad's cousins. He grew up with my mom with my brother in Springfield. Yeah. Like, literally streets apart. And then, Hill McKnight area, Mason Square area. And, like, I've been fortunate because the community is my family, And it's like a domino effect. So I just always have been immersed in community. And I always seek out to build and find community wherever I am.
Yeah.
But Springfield is just something unique. It is, like, people say a lot, they talk a lot, but it's just a very unique community that we have here.
What are the things that people say about Springfield?
Last April, I was privileged to, I started an organization called the Silhouette Brand as an opportunity to bring other resources to folks here because of stereotypes like, if you're from Springfield, you're not going to achieve anything or, I've been in spaces where people think we just tote guns and we shoot people on the first sight. Literally have had people come up and say that even when I went away to college, which is insane. It's just very negative portrayals of what it means to be from Springfield, especially if you're of color, especially if you're a Black person. And so with the Silhouette Brand, we held an event, a virtual event called Field Fest, in which we sought to provide a positive light and positive experiences for youth in the city of Springfield. It was a 2-day event. We brought a lot of outside resources so that in turn, people can be like, all right, this is going on in New York, this is going on in LA, it's going on in Philly. Yeah. Why can't we do this here? Why can't we have those same exact resources? Why can't we connect with these folks from across the way? Like, why? Like, what's the reason for that? Mm-hmm. It's important to be able to see stuff and be able to visualize, you know, just be able to visualize more and visualize things that you wouldn't traditionally be able to see. And that event was based in those stereotypes that we always try to dispel. And there's a really great community and a really great group of folks in this city, young people who are trying to break down different systems and bring to light more opportunities, like even the space that we're in, you know, currently, the ethnic study. So there's a lot of negative.
Shout out to Ethnic Study. Yeah, shout out to the Ethnic Study for hosting us. And Steph, thank you very much.
Yeah, Steph and Sembret, for sure, because there's just a lot of there's a lot of that energy and just wanting to shake up things, you know, seeing parents of generations and grandparents and just wanting to bring something fresh and new and bringing older or different resources into an older environment. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Once again, you just answered some questions that I already that I had about. Well, why the name Silhouette?
Yeah. So, you know, it's like, I think the really basis of that term was based in the definition, you know, a silhouette being like the black sort of outlier of a specific figure and always sort of being like the defining shape of a specific subject or a figure. And black folks, you know, we've been that defining structure of these greater structures and figures, and but always in the background, always there,
yeah,
always somewhat visible, but not always the main subject. And I think that's what inspired me to create Silhouette. Thank you for asking that. I actually haven't been asked that in a long time. And it always draws me back to why I wanted to create that. But we're always in the background.
Yeah.
We're always there.
Great name.
Yeah, thank you. You know, and it's how do we shed light on those silhouettes of those people who are always doing the work behind the scenes? How do we shed light on those people who have broken down those structures to build something new or provide support?
Yeah.
And so that's really where that came from.
You interned with State Representative Benjamin Swan, and you have Silhouette Brand that curates community-based programming. You're always a part of something that's for the betterment of the community. Mm. Mm-hmm. Is you working for a historic public black publication like Ebony an extension of that work?
Absolutely. So I think I have to go back to my parents. My mother, you know, I was her shadow. I was always with her, and I was always with my father. He did a lot of community work.
Yeah.
Growing up, he worked with unions, different politicians. He opened two businesses, actually more than two businesses, in the downtown Springfield area, in the Springfield area. He has done a lot of work in the community, maybe not always getting the recognition, but he's done the work.
Yeah.
And I've always been inspired by the work that he has done. And he's exposed me to a lot where I definitely have modeled a lot of my desire to be immersed in the community from him. And I think I'm definitely the both of their worlds because they just love community. And it's just, like I said, it's not a task. It's not a front. It's just who they are. And I think that definitely rubbed off on me. And following my dad around, like working with different politicians and being involved in community centered initiatives and being able to see that, just it just became super ingrained within me. And I think that those both of them instilled within me a love of blackness and black community, where I remember being in high school, I was like, okay, they always say, you know, find something that you love and then you'll never consider it work. What's something that you love? And I was like, well, I love being black. Which is weird for some people, and it was super weird, but I just love being black. Everything about black people, black culture, black history, black innovation, black music, black design, black fashion, everything. Which is, like I mentioned, I got my degree in African American studies, but understanding how through my obtaining of knowledge that I wasn't given, how can I then dispel that into the community?
Yeah.
So I definitely think it's a major extension of my love of community and being able to work for the betterment of the greater black community, for sure.
Have you ever wanted to make it out?
I think, Yeah. Well, yes. I think that's just, again, I think it has to do with privilege, just being able to put myself into the mindset. I was always told growing up, if your mind can conceive it, your heart can believe it, then you can achieve it. So it's like being in the mindset of, if I can envision being outside and just not being shackled to a certain expectation or thought, then I can really do anything. I think that's definitely what I have to do. But making it out in the sense of, if I choose to stay in Springfield, that's by my own choice.
Yeah.
It's not because somebody's telling me I can't do anything else. It's not because I'm, again, shackled to a specific situation. It's because I love or want to be here, which is what it's been for me.
Yeah.
But, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think in any community, especially in communities of color, but it really is any community, there are negative things. There are things that you've seen happen that you don't want to perpetuate for yourself or for, you know, should you have a family or whatever. I think that's definitely something I've thought about. But I know I will always have the option to do whatever because of my, you know, work ethic, my determination, and all of that for sure. But I think, yeah, definitely. I'm not going to say I haven't. I haven't always loved being in Springfield, but I had to learn to and kind of, like I said, sit with myself and get re-rooted in that.
Would you feel like, you know, maybe like a sellout in a way? Because, you know, you're so ingrained in the community. That if you were to ever leave, you might feel like you're turning your back on your people?
That's a great question. Because, yes, I've definitely wrestled with that thought. About for like a year and a half, I was working with the Springfield Museums. I left that position not too long ago, and it was a great opportunity. It's literally in the heart of downtown Springfield. Anybody who listens to this and is from the Western Mass area and Springfield area, you definitely know where the Springfield Museums are. And it was a phenomenal opportunity for me to reconnect with my community in different ways from that vantage point. And there was a period in time where I did feel myself becoming a little bit complacent, just not because of the work, but just because I'm like, okay, like, I have something here, you know. I can find a place to live. I can just kind of be here. And I think that stifled my sense of creativity just within my own self. And because I was doing the work, like I mentioned, with Field Fest and being able to do all these things and reconnecting with folks who I haven't talked to in a while or meeting new people and wanting to do so much for the city of Springfield, I have felt that if I step out, if I move, if I go anywhere, it's like, nah, you're just doing that for clout. Or nah, you're capping. Like, it's not something that you generally love. And, like, you've been capping for years. And I think that's, like, a little bit of imposter syndrome, but also I think just a general thought.
Yeah.
But I had a conversation with one of my good friends, and she was like, yeah, like, you're always going to go back home, so the work never has to stop or continue, like, or discontinue. It, you know, it doesn't matter. Wherever you go in the world, you can go across, you know, the ocean, move somewhere else, but you know where that home, you know where your home is, and you always have an obligation to give back to your home and support your home. So I think with that ideology, I won't feel like a sellout, or I won't feel like, you know, that's cap. I won't feel that at all. Yeah. You know,
this is it's a city, but it's a small city.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a big town. So how are you able to break out of that small town mentality?
That's another really great question.
I mean, I know you said that your family, your grandparents specifically, told you that there's more to what you see.
Yeah.
But how do you, sorry to cut you off, but how do you, you know, because I feel like the opposite of imposter syndrome, when, you know, when you're in these new places and you feel like you might not belong, is survivor's remorse. Because you'll leave.
Yeah.
And then you feel like you should have brought certain people with you. And And, you know, why did I make it? And so it's almost as if it's imposter syndrome at the same time. So,
yeah, I think that's a very great question. I have always, and I've been told, I love very hard. I love my people very hard.
Yeah.
I I want what's best for them, to the point where maybe it's tough love. Maybe it's I don't cut people breaks.
Yeah.
You know, I it's maybe a fatal flaw. I don't know. But I'm very hard on my people to hopefully inspire them and encourage them to want more. That's just always how I've been. That's how I was taught. So when I had the opportunity to go away to school, and granted, it really wasn't that far. It was like 3.5 hours. But like going away to school and like, you know, I was like, I can't lose touch with people. Like, you know, you always say that. Like, these are my people. Like, I'm never going to lose touch. But things happen, right? And you lose touch with folks. And it's unfortunate. It's sad. But I think I've been able to program my mind to the point of where, like, if I just continue to love hard and make myself a resource and make myself just available to folks, if they take it, then they take it. If they don't, then they don't. But all I can do, you know, is love on people or love on them from afar. Either you know, take the help and take whatever. But I think I've really, a little bit of guilt, but I think it's been such a blessing to see my, like, the people that I've grown up with, whether I've lost touch or not, whether we talk once or twice a year, it has been a blessing to see them thrive, whether they stay in this area or not, whether they go further, but thrive for whatever that means for them. And I think it comes to defining your own terms of success, defining what making it out looks like for you. It could physically mean making it out of your literal childhood home.
Yeah.
It could literally mean you making it out of the United States of America. It can mean a bunch of things. And no matter, you know, the people and family or friends, I think it's just really been great being able to see them blossom and define that for themselves. So I haven't really felt a sense of guilt like that. I think I started to, but I had to kind of check my own self and be like, you know, even if it's not this grandiose transition out of the city of Springfield or whatever, it doesn't matter. It's whatever it means for you. It's whatever it means for that person. So, and still, but not, I think it's all in mindset and not thinking that you're better than anyone else or not thinking that, like, you know, because I don't, and I'm the type of person, I don't feel like I've really made it out, if I'm being completely honest with you.
Yeah.
I probably won't feel like that for real. Like, I've done some cool things. That's how I look at it. But I think that's a lot of imposter syndrome. Like, I had a really cool opportunity a couple weeks ago. I got invited Friday night to go to LA to go to an event.
Kanye's
Black Future Brunch.
Black Future Brunch. I was about to ask you about that.
So I got that invite on a Friday. It was on Sunday. And I was like, okay, how am I going to make this happen?
Yeah.
And then I started to freak the hell out. I freaked out. And I was like, I don't know nobody like that. Maybe this was a mistake. I'm not supposed to be here. I'm not supposed to be there. Somebody's going to find out that I'm not as dope as I think I am in my mind or how I write. You know, that just happens to be luck. Like, I don't, like, you know, I started to spiral. But then I got there and, you know, fortunately, I was able to kind of talk myself out of it and had, like, a great opportunity and a great time and experience. But I don't really ever think I've made it out, even though I get to do cool things. So I think it's mindset, for sure. In terms of, like, survivors go, I think I'm still here. You know what I'm saying? So I don't think I've really felt that yet. But if I have started to feel little tidbits of that, I think it's really just, like, the mindset and just being able to recalibrate. Like, all right, like, everybody's making it. Everyone's healthy. They're successful. They're starting families, starting brands. They're doing it. So, you know, as long as I make myself a resource and their respective endeavors, I think it's cool.
Let's talk about that Black Future Brunch.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I got the email. I'm like, okay. I told my parents. I was like, yeah, I'm going to L.A. tomorrow. It was like, what does that mean? Like, what do you mean? Like, when I tell you it was like 11 o'clock at night, I got that email on Friday. I booked the ticket for 2 p.m. that next afternoon so I could be out. And fortunately, the ticket price happened to be like, it was maybe a couple tickets left. It was a great price.
It was normal. Yeah.
It was actually like a really, I thought it was going to be like, you know, like $600. Yeah. It was nothing even close. Found a great hotel. I flew out, got to my spot. I kind of like, all right, like, I'm here. I can't like get back on a flight to go back home. Like, I just have to see it through. And the day came, went to the event, and there were, you know, it was super Kanye-esque. It was just pitch black, selective lighting, fog, some different structures. People were setting up, and mind you, it was in a warehouse. It wasn't no name of the place. It was a warehouse.
Non-disclosed location.
Literally, just got the address, and it was just like, okay. I pull up. I see these two dudes dressed in black. They're like, hey, how are you? And I'm like, oh, I'm good. You here for the brunch? It's inside. I'm like, I bet. I go inside. Like I said, I see the lighting. And then I get to connect with some folks. I sign a couple of release forms. Get to meet some people. They bring us outside to wait while they continue setting up. And then finally, like, all right, you can go inside. So I'm, like, maybe one of the first four people to go inside this spot again. Like, watch your step. I'm stepping over the threshold. My eyes are adjusting to the darkness. I'm, like, I'm about to bust my butt. It's, like, it's dark. And then my eyes kind of come to, and I see this figure. And, like, this figure talking to another person. And there's one person in front of me, and they go and shake this person's hand. And I'm, like, that's Kanye. And it's just, you know how he wears, like, those big puffy black jackets? Yeah. And you know how he looks. And I see him, he's, like, right there. And there's a girl in front of me, shaking her hand. She goes away. He's like, hey, what's up? And I'm like.
He said that to you?
I'm like, who's he talking to? He's like, hey, what's up? And I was like, hi, you know, I'm like Savannah Taylor, Ebony Magazine. He was like, oh, word, like, I love what y'all are doing. Y'all doing great things. And I'm like, thank you. I appreciate it. Like, that really means a lot. And I go find my seat. And it's really, like, the vibe is giving, like, Last Supper. It was very interesting. It was on a Sunday. You know, you hear things about Hollywood and celebrities. I'm watching my back and whatever, not drinking no Kool-Aid. But it was actually a very interesting event. I won't say I'm the biggest Kanye fan, but I will say that I look at his persona a little bit differently. I'll kind of leave it there. But yeah. I do look at things a little bit differently. And then they had a performance by Sunday Service. Jason Lee of Hollywood Unlocked.
He put
together the event. Antonio Brown, he was there as well. Which was crazy. There were a lot of black media luminaries in the room, like writers that you probably, like, you know, look up to, and being able to be in that space and have that opportunity to connect with those folks meant a lot for me, especially because this is, like, my first, like, big, really role and stepping out on my own and being able to be looked at and respected for the things that I write meant a lot. And having that affirmation for me was really monumental. You hear things like, oh, you're a great writer. Like, I like what you do. But to hear that in a different way and be able to converse on that level and have those types of conversations meant a lot. So I made a lot of connections. Sunday Service was immaculate, great experience.
Yeah.
It definitely did a lot for my confidence, for how I position myself just as a writer and hopefully upcoming editor and just the work that I'm starting to do and really be in the spaces that I want to be in. So it definitely meant a lot, and I think it just got me in the mindset to want to win and continue to do things like that.
Yeah.
For sure.
Let's talk more about your writing now. Spend a lot of time on your upbringing and the mindset of a person from Springfield. But, you know, that all ties into who you are and just creatively, who were you said there was a lot of luminaries, a lot of writers that a person would look up to.
Yeah.
Who were some of your favorite writers?
Oh, man. I love so many. I love, I think it goes back to, like, that reverence, like a James Baldwin. Mm. I love the way he writes. Someone who challenges me when I read, but also my understanding of writing, is like Toni Morrison. When I was in college reading her stuff, I was like, this is hard. But, like, it really made me focus and think about the craft of writing.
Yeah.
I love Gwendolyn Brooks as a poet. I love the way she just constructs imagery and thoughts together. I love the poet Danez Smith, who's really amazing. Gosh, so many people. I also love, and it's somebody that I've been able to meet and connect with, Kierna Mayo. She is the former editor-in-chief of Ebony and of, like, Island Digital, and now she's, like, the vice president, I believe, I want to get her title right, at Rocklit, which is, like, a combination of, like, Rock Nation and another.
I've never heard of Rocklit.
Yeah, they're, I think, fairly new, but it's literally almost, like, black, it's like black culture meets literary publications. Like, yeah. It's pretty dope. And I've been reading a lot more of her writing after having the opportunity to work with her and get to know her a little bit more personally. And I love the way she just, I just love the way she writes. I wasn't able to work with her directly for a long time, but just the little tidbits of information she gave was amazing. She has a podcast called Culturati, which is pretty dope, and she talks about how she writes. Questions like that, sometimes I'm like, I'm thinking about like 1,000 people, but there's like so many people who have just, I think, really crafted and helped me craft and think of my writing differently and expand my mind as a writer. And even saying that is somewhat weird. I love to write. I've never really considered myself a writer, and I think that's that imposter syndrome. It's definitely that for me, but I'm getting more comfortable with it. But those are some folks I can definitely think of. There's so many other people.
You don't gotta hurt your brain.
Yeah, sorry. There's so many other people, but there's a lot. But obviously, I'm inspired by a lot of black writers who utilize their personal experiences to help others and just curate a certain type of experience when you're reading their writing.
Yeah, I was gonna ask you. You've been a part of a lot of different things, and you never considered yourself a writer, like you just said. So what did you consider yourself as? Because you do have a background working. You worked in the music business as an intern for Cash Money via Republic Records.
Mm-hmm. What I considered myself as was, and I think people are coming to terms with this phrase a little differently, was just a jack of all trades.
Yeah.
But I think people, there's like a thing on social media going around where they expand upon that phrase, jack of all trades, master of none, but it's better to be like a master of whatever than a master of none or something like that. But I just thought I was able to do multiple things pretty well. It got me to other, opportunities. I honestly, like, I don't know what I consider myself as. Like seriously, I think that was like a little, like, cycle and process I had to go through myself, and like a self-confidence and a general just coming of age for myself to figure out. But now as I write literally every day and I'm reading every day and I have to be, my writing's being looked at, I think it's more so like I've earned the ability to be able to say that, and it's less of based off of people's affirmation of my writing or like the pat on the back that I get, but more so of how I have to consistently like work at it and to create something that is accessible, understood, and hopefully is able to resonate with other people. So I think that's how I've been able to become comfortable calling myself a writer.
Yeah. Because you're putting that work in.
I think, yeah. And I think, I mean, and that speaks to other things that I feel like I have to work hard at something to be able just to enjoy being able to say something. But that's just, I think, how I look at it. Because there's so many great writers that I respect, whether within, like, my circle or people I went to school with or whatever. I just think it's something that I take seriously. I just think that's what that is.
Yeah. How does a person... There's so much stimulation in the world coming from so many different directions. Yeah. How does a person sit down and have the attention span to read a book these days?
Oh, man. I just literally just had that conversation with my mother the other day because it's hard.
Yeah.
It's literally hard to sit down and read a book.
And it used to be so easy
growing up. It used to be so easy. Like, I could read 3 books at a time. And I loved that. Like, I was always reading. And I loved to read. But, you go through life. You get jobs. You write for a living. And sometimes that fun kind of gets sucked out of it. But it's really hard to just sit and read one book or even read one page in a book. But it's very important in order to stimulate your mind in a certain way. I think that having moments to just cut out the distractions, just center yourself, even if you gotta lock yourself in a room to just read.
Yeah.
Like a physical book. And it's nothing like reading a physical book. Not just like going through Apple News or like, Kindle and so on, but like, I mean, it's me too.
I read more articles. I used to growing up, I was like a voracious reader. And
it's not the same. It's just, and I think that's just the way that things are going with, you began to talk about how publications aren't really in print anymore. The print industry has been struggling, and just people have reverted to digital formats, which I think is interesting and it's great, and I don't see anything wrong with that. But there's just a specific art to sitting down to reading a physical book. It's a certain experience. Like, I'm still the person, if you fold my page, we're fighting. Like, it's don't mess with my book.
I'm
you know what I'm saying?
I'm a page folder. I'm notorious for that.
It depends on the type of book. But, like, for real, like, I feel it's more so, like, if I haven't touched the book yet, and you just, and I show you the book, you're like, oh, let me see. And I didn't have my time to, like, get into the book yet. Yeah. Don't do that. Like, it's like.
It's like creasing sneakers.
It's like creasing sneakers. And it's like if somebody takes a bite of your food before you do.
Oh, yeah.
That's what that's like for me. That's exactly what that's like for me. So I think it's like falling in love with that again and being able to just like hold a book in your hand and look at it for the first time. And I think being in this role has allowed me to get back in touch with reading a physical book.
Yeah.
And as opposed to, you know, scrolling, because I am a scroller for sure.
Yeah. Where do you get your, is that where you get your inspiration from to write, from reading more? Does that help you improve your vocabulary and your storytelling, your you know, narrative creation?
Definitely. I mean, I'm also on social media 24/7. Like, it is what it is.
Yeah.
I love the way that technology, someone really great taught me that at one of my internships, how technology is simply a medium for storytelling. And I've been able to see that more with just being on social media and working, you know, for ebony.com and being able to do that. Definitely reading. I was a kid, I read the dictionary growing up. I learned new words just going through the dictionary. It was like, you know, your parents say you ain't got nothing to do, read a dictionary. And I did. And I learned new words. Like, I like going and finding different ways to say things. And I think that, like, I look at even, I get like a word of the day every day. I started doing that a little bit more frequently. Yeah. And that's very helpful. But just being able to, and I also keep a very serious list of things on my iPad notes.
Yeah.
And I started carrying a notebook again. And I think just writing those things down, like, well, maybe I wrote something like that about this topic, or I'm trying to think, for example, just something that I've written might connect to something else, which then connects to something different. I think of writing like a puzzle, and I think, and literally like a science, and you're piecing these things together to create a certain experience when people are reading, because as we know, reading something is completely different than when you're saying something out loud, or when you're looking at an image or a painting or something like that. So I do think of it as a science, and I think about what chemicals and what compounds, you know, what makes that what it is, what makes the overall final product. So I think I draw inspiration definitely from books, from just talking with other people, social media for sure, which can be a slippery slope, but yeah, I think just digital formats for sure, but just reading definitely in different ways.
Can you go into the science of writing, like you said?
Yeah. When I'm writing something, and I think it just goes back to maybe the attention span, but it's always like a bajillion different routes. It's like one of those like Mad Libs or whatever. There's like a million different routes or ways that a certain piece can go, or the opening line. It's funny, and I've told this story frequently, like publicly. When I was in third grade, I had to write an essay. This is when they were teaching you how to do like the like three paragraph essays or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I think they use like that cake analogy or something. And I wrote the essay, and I got like an F. Wow. And I was like, what? I was like, and I got an F, and my teacher, like, she tore my page up, and no shade, but I already didn't like her. So I was like, absolutely not. But then, like, I don't know what it was. When I get mad, that's, like, what pushes me to do something. That's how I learned how to ride a bike. That's how I learned how to drive a car. When I get mad, I'm like, yeah, nah, like, I have to get it. And then the next papers, I never got an F on no paper ever again. So that really propelled me. And I think, of course, that format helps me. But then, of course, as you get older in your English classes and it's not just the cake format, but it is like the creative opener.
Yeah.
And then you have the thesis, and then you have, you know, that first paragraph, and then you want to have a really great opening line, and then the body details, and thinking about it that way. But then it's like, all right, it's not always that going to be that black and white. Yeah. And then it becomes more of an experience. And then it's like, well, what would I want to see? And what? How can I illustrate a very profound image?
Yeah.
And I think it's also balancing that with not trying to sound too smart or not trying to offend people, I think, which is something that you have to write for specific audiences, obviously. So yeah. I think it's learning that, too. But at least for me, it's always like, it's all these different lines and all these different just ways that something can go and that the end product will turn out. And it's like, I'm going back, I'm retyping, or I'm scratching something out. And maybe this line is here, but it can go down here. But I think it's super fun, and that's why I enjoy writing, because you're always trying to, like, figure out a puzzle. Like, a 100-piece puzzle with your hands maybe ain't all that fun, but for me, writing is that.
Let's talk about your you as a marketing intern, at Cash Money.
Yeah.
How different is doing work in the music business compared to being a writer?
Yeah. So that experience cemented my love of entertainment and just culture. I was the kid that was always reading the little teeny bopper gossip magazines and collecting them and, you know, filling out the sweepstakes so you can get flown out to see, you know, those little things. I absolutely lived for that. So I was always thinking, well, how can I be in those spaces? And my dad is like a master networker, connector. There's never a space that I have been with him where he hasn't got me to the front of the line. Like, for real, like, through networking. And so that kind of stuck with me, and I also think was transferable to just, like, the entertainment industry, for sure, and just getting to be in spaces with folks through communication and networking and talking with people. So I definitely learned a lot about professionalism, the perception that people have from something you put out, I think is the biggest lesson that I learned. Marketing is, I love digital marketing. I think it's super interesting, and it's another platform of accessibility. But I never truly understood the power of just, like, what consumers are fed or shown and given and how they internalize that.
Yeah.
I think the music industry is a major, like, example of that. Being able to be in certain rooms, like, I got to, like, meet Jacquees and, like, work on, like, his campaign and get to see little things and learn little tricks of the trade. And, like, that was, like, major for me. And, like, seeing them in the room when they're picking songs and seeing which one's going to break and which one's going to, like, be make the album and what goes into this, that, and the third and how are we going to market that to the everyday consumer. During that time, Scorpion came out, Nicki's Queen, Jacquees' debut album, and there was, like, Kiana LaDay's debut album.
She was on Cash Money.
Kiana LaDay was Republic Records. So Cash Money is under Republic.
Yeah,
exactly. So I was very lucky to essentially be at two labels at one time.
Yeah.
So that was a great opportunity. Duckworth had just really came out. Gosh, who else? A whole lot of people. But I think being able to look at marketing, but also using words, right? So how is what you say and what you write and how does that lead to a domino effect of what people understand and consume? And I think being able to use words in that way was super fun. And I was like, yep, marketing, that's it for me. Like, and I still love that. It still could be. I think it uses words in a different way, in a different sort of capacity than just writing, obviously, stories and articles does. But it definitely allows you to really use that sort of science mentality when writing, for sure.
Do you see marketing as more of a, let's say, administrative role, or do you see it as a creative role?
I think it can be both. Like, I think with marketing, there's just certain things that you have to market as, like, you know, for business owners and different business entities and different things like that. But I think it's also super creative. I mean, when you look at rollouts for different artists or celebrities or films and stuff like that, it's super creative, and you have to really tap into that.
Yeah.
Good marketers are able to tap into their creative part of their brain to create something grandiose. Like, that's the great part about it. If you're really good and you're really able to convey a certain message. So I think it's definitely both.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. You really have to. I think it has to be both, honestly. I think it has to be for you to be really good at it and for people to be able to, like, dig what you're putting out. Mm-hmm. I think you have to really be creative. Not, like, just, like, I could finesse my words, yeah, but, like, you have to, like, generate something that's a whole entire experience. And then, of course, there's different types of marketing, but I think you really have to think outside of the box for sure.
And tap into the mind of the consumer and the casual consumer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And while still speaking to your niche consumer,
yes,
and understanding, you know, what they're going to benefit from, yeah, what they're going to feel when you put it out for sure. And that requires a hell of a lot of creativity for sure. Yeah.
A selfish question. You met Birdman?
I'm sorry?
You met Birdman?
I haven't met Birdman, but I have spoken with him on the phone.
How is he?
I don't know. Like, Birdman and, excuse me, Baby and Slim. It was, I don't know. I was scared. I don't know. I was like, because I was answering the phones, and, like, he was like, oh, can I speak to the head of marketing at that time, SVP, was Katina Bynum, like, legend in the music industry. And I was, like, her intern. And he answered the phone. I was like, you know, like, hello, like, this is so
hey, Mr. Birdman.
Yeah, he was like, can I speak to Katina? And I was like, right away. And it was just, like, a couple of words. And, like, you know, like, I was scared to death, you know? I don't know. Like, that was cool. It's something I could say, you know, happened.
Yeah.
It was just, like, I can go back to school and be like, yeah, I had to answer the phone one day. You know, Birdman. But, yeah, I think, who else? No, Wayne, the Carter 5 was about to come out. But it didn't. I think they had just begun the process. Yeah. So there was a lot of conversations like that. So if I had to be on a phone call and take meetings for the person I directly reported to, her name was Kanique Swenson. She's now the director of marketing at Columbia Records. Mm. And she's the person I referenced, so I reached out to her via DM. She went to Syracuse. Before I went to Syracuse, I reached out to her. I was like, you don't know me from anything. And she actually responded. We kept casual conversation, and then finally she was like, I have an opening this summer. Do you want it? And I was like, yeah, I do want it. And I stayed the summer with my cousin in Harlem. Wow. And I stayed the summer, and I learned the ins and outs of art marketing that summer, and that was, like, life-changing because, like I said, I learned that I wanted to be in spaces of, like, entertainment and culture and seeing how culture shifted society for sure. Like, that was hip-hop and, like, R&B. Yeah. There's really nothing like it. And that's, like, a whole nother conversation, but there's just such a power in how their words and the things that they put out, how that shifts culture, for sure.
Is there something from your background in marketing and the music business that you bring to writing? And is there something from writing that you bring to marketing and the music business?
So I honestly, just like I said, being an intern, like, I had to write a lot, typing up, like, notes and typing up, like, doing one sheets and just, you know, whatever tasks they had for me. But I think being a writer, it was about being able to convey a message properly. So when they looked at them notes, they were like, who wrote this? Or, like, that don't make no sense, because they were going out to, like, heads of the company. So I think that science and being able to, like, even though it's on a very small level, but being able to think of things that way really helped me with the work I was able to do there, no matter what it was. And then vice versa, the power of networking and connecting with people and being able to, you get told certain things, like being able to ask folks for questions, but it's completely different. It's a different ball game in that industry. So I think I was able to bring that sort of interpersonal connection to when I've been able to work in marketing and or social media marketing and things like that.
Yeah. You said something earlier about print journalism not being what it used to be. I've also often heard people say that print is dead. Do you feel the same?
I think it's dead because entities probably want it to be, just because there's such a great shift to digital, you know, platforms. But again, like, there's really nothing like holding a magazine
and that smell.
It You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, it's like when you open up a box of, like, brand new shoes. Like, yeah. You get that brand new car, that new car smell.
Or when you open a CD.
There's nothing like it. It's, like, freshly pressed. It's just the ink on the page, being able to feel it for the first time, knowing that, essentially, you are the first person to take this home and, like, go through it. You can mark it up. You can fold in pages. You can do whatever you want. There's nothing like that experience. And I think small experiences like those, even if they are considered small, I think we've just gotten away from those little things in life. But there's nothing like it. Ebony actually put out their first commemorative issue of Ebony in 3 years. It's actually out now at Target and Barnes & Noble. And I don't know about you, but I used to love going to Barnes & Noble. I used to, you know, whenever I got like an A in class, that determined how many books I was able to get or how many, you know, magazines or whatever. But there's just nothing like that. And I think there obviously is a demographic of people who still respect that, which is why I believe print will never truly be dead, because that just takes away a lot. Like, we're in a cafe bookstore right now. Like, I don't think you could ever not have this.
Yeah. But as far as print journalism,
I think it's a specific art.
Yeah.
And I think there will always be a need for it. So I don't think it'll ever be completely dead. It definitely maybe is a dying field, but I don't ever think it'll be completely dead. It's just a specific art. Like, the way you write for print journalism, just a certain way you convey and just do things, it's a different process than if you're writing something for, like, an online. Like, it's completely different.
Yeah.
It's completely different. So I think it just will never totally be dead. Sure, it's dying, but dead? Nah, I don't think that's even possible, personally.
Let's go into that, though. The way that you write in a magazine compared to how it's written online. Like, what are the differences?
Yeah, I mean, even being able to, and that's something that I've truly learned working at Ebony and being able to see it in its resurgence recently. The process of, you know, planning for a magazine and a cover, and that's months, right, of generation for, like, a specific topic or whatever the cover and that specific piece of print is going to be, that print issue is going to be. So the process of writing, you might have a little bit longer to get out a piece. You might have a little bit longer to write the cover article, whereas online, I'm busting out 4 or 5 pieces a day, right? And you got to get certain things. It's current events. You got to, it's certain things that are timely and evergreen. Some things are evergreen, of course, but you have to just, with digital platforms, you don't get to really, it doesn't always allow for that artistic sort of process that you would generally have if you're creating like a solid piece of work, body of work for a print issue. The online, you have to kind of have that process every day because you got 15 plus pieces sometimes going out a day, depending on the online publication. So it's like a completely different process. Sometimes you don't have the time to really, I love to take my time and put thought into what I write.
Yeah.
And like think, be very intentional. That's something that's really big for me. I think, you know, we've seen the fake news, we've seen people putting things out, and, you know, reading is fundamental. Not everybody's reading these days. Mm-hmm. So it's like I'm very intentional about what I'm putting out, and there's not always that time allotted if something's priority and needs to go out. So it's just a completely different process.
Do you think that, because clickbait is a thing.
Yeah.
Salacious headlines are a thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. When I grew up reading magazines, I didn't really see clickbait unless... you can literally click a magazine, but when you're in a supermarket and you're about to check out and you see the tabloids like Star Magazine and all that, that's like the physical copy version of clickbait.
Yep.
But that's literally a gossip magazine. Ebony's not a gossip magazine.
Yeah.
But on a lot of magazines that aren't traditionally gossip magazines, on their websites, you'll see clickbait.
Yep.
Is that a thing in print? You know, outside of the gossip magazines, like clickbait, like, you know, say making a headline or a byline that's, you know, it always has to draw you in. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to look controversial.
I think, I mean, for sure. I think you just mentioned it, like, with tabloids, and you'd see, like, oh, like, the Queen of England and, like, her son, they are starting a cult. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, things like that. It's, like, the most outrageous things. Or they morph somebody's body to look like 100 pounds heavier than they actually are or less than they actually are. Like, that's always been a thing. I think that's the mentality that has fueled digital clickbait. I mean, those headlines are what you get to pick up, and that's the same thing for clickbait. It's just, you know, more digital. Yeah. But it's important for those who are journalists and writers to not go the clickbait route. I mean, we have Shade, No Shade, but, like, The Shade Room, like, you know, those blogs and things like that. I saw, like, a headline before I was coming here, and it was just, like, or not even that. What was the Biden's funding $5 million for crack pipes?
Yeah.
That's literally not it. But it's, like, and on top of that, it's the responsibility of the writer. If you are going to use clickbait, make sure that the rest of the information is accurate.
And then people, but that's the thing. It's all about engagement. You
exactly.
know, people make a headline like that, post it on socials, and
it gains traction.
Exactly, gains tractions, and then, you know, people share it to their story, and then they have they comment.
Oh my god! It sounds outrageous.
Oh my god! He's selling crack.
You know what I'm saying?
He's selling crack out the Oval Office.
Yeah, and it's like that. I actually ended up, like, I was so furious. I think I broke it down on my story for people. Like,
but people don't care.
They don't care. But I did. I will say there were more people than I expected to be like, you know what? You're right. Yeah. I was wrong. I definitely just jumped off the headline. You have to train your audience. You have to train people, unfortunately, especially in this digital age, to learn how to read things. Because, like, we kind of got thrown into this digital age. It wasn't always, like, it wasn't training for your parents to learn how to use the iPhone. Sure. It was you, right? So, like, there wasn't, like, training for people to learn how to become more conscious consumers with things, especially in communities of color. You just, and it's not even too, I'm not even going to discount the fact that there are powers that be that put out specific headlines and things. Like, it's all, that's all true.
Yeah.
That's all real, and that's all very true. But it's like, you have to, if you're a writer, and you're only going based off clickbait, and everything else you write is trash, you
are a tabloid.
You are a tabloid. But it's like, you have a responsibility to be truthful. As writers and as journalists, we have a responsibility to be documentarians, to be researchers.
And hold people accountable.
And to hold people accountable, but also because when we're dead and gone, people will look back. Like, no matter what you do, there will be some pit somewhere where your piece or your blog or whatever, and people in the future will learn from that. I think that's something I've always thought, and that's why I used to keep a journal. Like, one day, like, not to get too morbid, but one day I'm going to be gone, and somebody's going to have access to this, and this is how they will think about the future. That will think about the past.
Yeah,
that's how we've learned. We learn things about the civil rights or slavery through what, you know, slave journals and, like, things like that. Like, it's all very real today, but we have a responsibility to be truth tellers. Mm-hmm. And to, if we're going to call ourselves, like, certain things, we have to tell the truth. We have to document things. Yeah. And sometimes it does take a lot of extra work, like, to do the research as you should. But not everybody's doing that. That's, like, and that's across the board, but especially in writing. And it's frustrating, I think, when you see a lot of gossip blogs and the way people just solely operate off of clickbait. It becomes very frustrating because they're not doing their due diligence. And then everybody else has to suffer. And then nobody else is going to click on the article.
Yeah.
That maybe is not as salacious, but it's telling real truth.
Yeah.
They're going to go click the Biden selling crack pipes out the Oval Office. And he's making us pay for it. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, come on. Like, for real? Like, come on. The government, that's another story. But, like, come on. Come on.
So how important is it to be a credible journalist? Mm-hmm. How important is it to uphold that responsibility and being responsible with what you put out into the world?
Yeah, I think that's of the utmost importance. Generally speaking, being conscious of what you put out into the world, but from my positionality as a Black woman, as a Black person, and as a Black writer, I think it's like an absolute obligation to be conscious and careful with what we put out, because a lot of times what we're putting out is for the betterment of our own community and people who look like us, and unfortunately we have a lot of other factors and other people who are delegating our worth and or dictating rather our worth and our well-being based off what we put out into the world. So that's an added layer. But we do have an obligation. Like, we have, like, specifically with Ebony, we have such a legacy audience, and we have people who have, Ebony has been around since 1945, like, so over 75 years. And so there are people whose grandparents, great-grandparents, parents, you know, who have seen the publication and watched it grow and have been there since the beginning. Like, well, Ebony and Jet specifically, because we are under the historic Johnson publishing company, and historically founded by John H. Johnson. You know, Jet was the publication that put out the story and image of Emmett Till. Ebony had a article section in which Dr. Martin Luther King wrote articles for Living Life, where people wrote in their questions and he gave advice. Like, we were the number one source that people went to on how to live life as a Black American, as Black diasporic people. And what they put out was what dictated a lot of things within culture. So, and that's, you know, developed into so many other outlets. And it's great to see that we have so many more Black media outlets since then, and publications since then. But we have an obligation because we have it for, it's for our people, but it's also just in the way we shift culture. Like, we already know mainstream culture is on our backs, right? It's founded. There would be no culture if it was not for our people. So it's like, you know, we have to become more conscious. And that's, like, even with the music we put out, or, like, the type of fashion. And I think that gets into, like, a gatekeeping conversation for sure. But it's, like, I think we just have to definitely be conscious because we, again, are truth tellers. We are documentarians of history. Mm-hmm. We are at the forefront of a lot of things. And people will look to what we write, literally, to dictate the future. Like, literally, people will be reading what we write for years, even if it's some little gossip blog or something like that, you know?
What do you think you contribute as a journalist?
Now, I believe that something that I take pride in and what I always strive to contribute is a balance of cultural understanding and cultural mindsets to current events and connecting them to how we operate currently. Like, you know, the you can't understand where you're going if you don't understand the past. That's something I take very seriously. And I always think about that when I'm writing. Like, I wrote a piece today about, like, Wendy Williams' show got canceled, right? And it's like,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, man, she got canceled.
So after all of these new hosts, they just canceled it?
So what's going to happen is that the guest host, Sherry Shepherd, she will be taking over that slot in the fall with her own TV show called, not the Wendy Williams show, called Sherry. So that's a little piece of information. It's just interesting, but it's like, you know, some people outside of our community be like, well, who the heck is Wendy Williams? Like, who is that, right?
Crazy.
You know, but it's like, we know in this community who she is. Our parents, grandparents probably know who Wendy Williams is,
I grew up on Wendy Williams.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, my uncle, like, a devout Wendy Williams listener when she was on radio. So, you know, when I'm writing about these things, I have to make sure that there's an understanding of who she was. She's not just this popular culture figure that popped up out of nowhere. Like, nah, say what you want, but she's been around. Like, she's done a lot. So, you know, whenever I'm writing, or what's another piece I've written? I was able to speak with Dr. Yusuf Salam of the Exonerated
Five.
Yes, yeah, so, like,
I like that you call them the Exonerated Five,
It's exactly, you know, Central Park Five, as many people might know them are.
Villainized.
You know, exactly. That's that clickbait and that sort of salacious headlines, those salacious headlines you were speaking of earlier. But being able to talk with him and bring it full circle into why his story and why their story is so important to know in 2022, well, 2021 at the time, you know. So being able to round those things out, you just have to kind of have like a circular understanding of the past and things that have happened to connect us to today. And I think that's what's so interesting about writing and journalism as well.
I know that you didn't always see yourself as a writer, but now that you are and that you have been, how long have you been writing now?
Oh, man. I want to say, like, for real, for, like, different, like, publications or entities, I'll say at least, like, 5 years. I'll say at least 5 years.
So are you the writer that you've always wanted to be?
I'm becoming that. I think I'm becoming that because I have the space and resources to do so. But I don't think I'm all the way there. Something that I definitely want to get more into is being able to do more like original content and like sharing my perspectives on culture, on Black culture. That's something that's like the peak of what I want to get to. And I've been fortunate to have those opportunities to speak in that way. Like I had to write a story about like Bath and Body Works and they had that Black history. if you've seen that Black History campaign where they put like Kente cloth on previously released products, you know? And I was, you know, I wrote up, I was like, they should have known better. Like, you know, there are Black folks who would be like, you know, it's something. And there are Black folks who'd be like, again, you should have known better.
Yeah.
You know, but I was able to put a little bit of my personal thought into it as sort of an opinion piece, but also just being straightforward. So I think I want to do more of that.
Yeah.
My goal, hopefully, and my sort of sense of manifestation with soon is to write, you know, a cover story. That's my goal. So I'm continuing to train myself and pick up on things as I'm editing for other, you know, writers and as I'm writing myself and editing myself. And I have a phenomenal manager, our managing editor. Her name is Joanne Amay. She's absolutely phenomenal. She teaches me new things every day, which is what I love about being in this position. Like, I never will proclaim to know everything, but she gives it to me straight. Like, I can't say enough good things about her, and she teaches me so much from her experience. And then just basic things like, yeah, you might know the basis of grammar, but there might be little things you forget. Or, like, how certain, you know, structures read differently, you know? So I think that I'm slowly but surely, but also really fastly becoming the writer I want to be. I'm not there yet, but I'm having the opportunity to become that.
In your Instagram bio, it says that you're culturally conscious. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Culturally conscious. I think I take pride in being aware of culture. So it's almost like when you step, like, it's like reading the room, right? Like when you're saying, like when you're in a certain spaces and you're saying certain things, I do take pride in being able to read culture in a specific way, which then informs how I move, what I say, what I write, how I interact with people, what programs I'm involved in, and being able to bring that back, especially when communicating with folks within or outside of the community. I do take pride in that. That's something I've been able to really coin for myself, but it's like a personal mantra to always strive to be like, I want to be one of those people who are like, you know, 60 years from now and I've lost touch on the pulse of the culture, you know? I think that's something that it happens, but I think if you want to be successful in this realm and just in general, you have to be in touch with younger generations and older generations for sure. So that's what that means.
I like that.
Yeah.
The term culture has been so
buzzy.
Yeah, the past few years, you know, and then I think that when things become so ubiquitous, they kind of lose meaning 100%. Over time. So,
absolutely.
What does the culture mean to you?
So, you're 100% right. People have used and abused culture, especially in mainstream media. I cringe when folks say, like, you know, this is for the culture, doing it for the culture. Yeah, man, culture, because, like, there's so many different nuances and undertones when certain people not of this community say that. There's different cultures for different groups of people, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's obviously, like, a societal culture, but there's a culture is different. But when people tend to say it now, they're speaking of a very specific type of culture, and these are cultures that they're not necessarily in. Katina Bynum, like I mentioned, who was a former, she's the head of licensing now with Universal Music. But she mentioned in one meeting that we had, talking about, you know, working with these hip-hop artists and how things, certain songs be portrayed, she said there's a difference between being in the culture and of the culture.
Yeah.
You know? And, like, some people that might go completely over their heads, but it's a difference in your end because that's been your experience.
Yeah.
Than when you're just, like, you're in the culture, you know, you get invited to certain cookouts, right? I put that in quotes.
Oh,
like,
God.
You know, get invited to the cookout.
Hate the term.
Right? Or you're same. Or you have certain access. You're the only said person in the room because you're down, right? But there's also a difference when it's your actual lived experience because it's generational. It's not something you could take on and off. It's something that you it's inherently a part of you. Whether you choose to accept it or not is a different story, but it's inherently a part of you. Like me and you and I can have this conversation. We can have a conversation. Yeah. And things are instantly understood. Mm-hmm. Like this, like that cookout understanding. People might be listening to this, and if they don't get
it. What are they talking about? Cookout? It's winter.
Exactly. Why? Because they're not as part of a certain, that certain culture. Yeah. But they will take that culture. They will use it and take it off. They will appropriate that culture. They will suck it dry, and they will take all the goodness out of it and then give it back and throw it back with nothing left with bones. They will do that. But it's a specific difference, and I think, like I said, that goes almost into a gatekeeping realm of a conversation. It obvious goes into an appropriation area of conversation.
Yeah.
And specifically the way in which Black culture has been abused by mainstream society, by white society, by white America, and white Eurocentric values globally, actually. My best friend spent time in Berlin, and they had Black culture parties.
Whoa.
Literally, where they dressed up as, you know, figures from Black culture.
In blackface.
Wow. You know, and that's culture to them. It's something that they can appropriate. You go around the world, there is not one area where Black culture specifically has not influenced.
For sure.
You know, so I think that culture conversation, culture is obviously, you know, by definition, like a traits or behaviors that a certain set group of use to sort of dictate and control and just operate within themselves.
Yeah.
But when we say culture, that has been defined as being subsections and sub sets of Black culture.
Yeah.
Which, you know, can be an issue, and probably, but that's the way that it's been defined in society. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What advice would you give the new Savannah Taylor, or the upcoming Savannah Taylor?
That's so interesting. I think to be true to yourself, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of people that I personally experience who have, of course, been naysayers. I'm sure we all can relate to that. Or, you know, we've had those teachers who've been like, you have high expectations, but that's not going to work out. Or, you know, in spite of the odds or in spite of negativity, staying true to yourself and staying your path, not being afraid to dream big and literally dream what you want to dream and finding a way to see it through.
Yeah.
I think is super important because, I mean, it might take time. It might take a different route. Nothing's linear. But I think being able to imagine greater for yourself will ultimately pay off. Staying rooted to whatever your sense of community or your people or your passions are is super important. Staying rooted is super important, and not losing yourself and not getting lost in the sauce and not getting, you know, taken off your path, but always being rooted to something that holds you down and at your core. And maintaining a good work ethic, I think, is super important. I don't want to sound like older people where they be like, these new kids today, but like, there's just a it's a difference, I feel like, in work ethic with younger people that I've worked with or talked to. And it's part of that is good because I feel like people are just beginning to know their self-worth.
Yeah.
And it's like you don't have to just lie down and take anything, which is phenomenal. But there's also just a certain level of grit that is healthy.
Yeah.
And that helps you to get to certain places. Mm-hmm. And you persevere in a different way. You grind a little differently, not to the point of, like, death, but, like, you grind because you love or you want something so badly, there's a certain hunger that you have, or that you're not just going to settle for mediocrity, you're not just going to settle for less than, you know.
Yeah.
So I think there's definitely just a certain hunger to maintain, and that comes with a certain level of work, having a certain work ethic for sure. But also just being happy, finding whatever the happiness is for you, staying in touch with things that bring you joy, bring you peace, always finding ways to recenter your peace. And if most importantly, if it's not said to you, then it ain't been said at all. I think that's something I wish I had learned earlier. Because if things aren't said to you directly, then it's not been said. And I think that helps with your personal understanding of yourself and not seeking validation from people who are not you, who do not mean anything, and just doing things because you enjoy them. And I think if I had known that, my understanding of me being a writer or just loving to write would have been a little bit, I would have been a little more quicker, a little bit more resolute in that for sure.
What are you working on now?
Working on, so I honestly, I want to do more community centers outside of my work, just getting back to more community centered events and culturally conscious programming.
Yeah.
And collaborating with other community organizations and folks that I've gotten to know. I miss that sense of planning and doing things like that. So that's something I'm ideating and looking to get back into. Also, in terms of writing, I have a couple of interviews coming up on ebony.com. So I am working on those and writing those. That's probably what I'll be doing after I leave here. So definitely getting those things scheduled, but also continuing to manifest things for myself. I'm going to the Bahamas this week for an assignment. I'll be covering.
Great work trip. Great location.
I'll say.
For sure.
I'll say. The story of Dorothy Mother Pratt, who will be inaugurated as the first woman governor of the Bahamas. Hmm. So I will be covering that, and I'm very excited for that story. I've never been, so I'm excited to be immersed in that culture for sure. That society, so I think that would be a lot of fun, but a lot of interviews and cool projects and cool stories and things that our readers and just our community will be able to benefit and take some things away from for sure.
Yeah. And what's next for you?
What's next? Continuing the hustle, you know, continuing to learn.
Yeah.
Learn so that I can become a better me, become a better writer, you know, learning the tricks of the trade. Is very important to me, in line with, you know, those programs that I want to start or get involved in, finding ways to bring the outside inside to the city and, you know, continue to grow with Ebony for as long as they'll have me and as long as I'm able to provide value for sure. But definitely just seeing what is possible and hopefully manifesting that.
And last question. Why do words matter to you?
Words matter to me because they are an opportunity and an outlet to see myself reflected on a page, on a document.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a metaphorical mirror in a sense. I think words are so beautiful. Like, there's nothing like just reading a beautifully crafted sentence, a paragraph that just gives you chills, and it's just a certain feeling that you get through words and using words positively to inspire, to connect with people, to see your future, whether you're writing a list or whether you're writing a diary entry or writing a letter. If people still do that, some do. It just matter because they're just integral to our everyday life in ways that some people don't realize. But there's a beauty and there's an art with words and crafting them to make somebody feel good or to make yourself feel good. There is just such an intrinsic power in the written word, whether digital or, you know, being physically written out. There's just such a power to it. And there's really nothing like it. There's nothing like it at all. Yeah.
For sure. And I think that's it for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you, Savannah M. Taylor of Ebony Magazine,
yes.
Of Springfield, Massachusetts,
yes.
Of the community.
Yes.
Thank you for coming here tonight, and I appreciate you for sure.
Thank you
for reaching out. Yeah.
Thank you for this, you know, endeavor that you're on and this work and reminding people that words matter and. They are super important and shedding light on, you know, folks who work with words. I appreciate you tapping me for this. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Yeah. All right. Words matter. And make sure that you rate, comment, and subscribe.
Yes.
I'm finally remembering to say that. And you can just plug your socials and everything else you have going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Across all social media platforms, Sav, S-A-V-M, Taylor. You can find me Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. You can find me on LinkedIn, same thing. My inboxes do be crazy, but I do my best to respond. Definitely, if there are pitches or just wanting to talk or just explore conversations like the ones we're having, I'm definitely open. I think it's about having those lines of communication with folks, so I'm always open. If I have the means to, I'm always open to those types of conversations. So definitely feel free to follow, and I will do my absolute best.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.